Having reached their conclusions, the Military Security Service, Royal Ulster Constabulary, OS-13, and even the Republic of Ireland's Garda began to watch, listen, and pray. There were people who had become involved almost by accident, or so it seemed. Take Teresa Murray, for instance. Teresa was named for Saint Teresa of Lisieux, the little flower of Jesus. As an infant, she learned to play on this fact of life. She would go into her parents' pocket handkerchief garden and ostentatiously smell the flowers. She would even caress them with her little hands, and her mother would croon, "Oh, the joy of it! You'll be our little flower, so you will." But as Teresa, who answered only to either Tess or Tessa, grew, so she started to regard her mother and father as a pair of blinking idiots. In truth, they were simple folk. He, an unskilled worker at Shorts, the maker of airplanes. She, a dinner lady at the local school 4 days a week. They lived in a part of Belfast that was almost untouched by the Troubles, for they had inherited the little house from her father's sister, the only member of this branch of the Murray family who had, until Tess, made something of her life. And that was a point as sore as a gumboil with the Murray seniors. What concerned them was not that Geraldine had died with money and a little property, but the way in which she'd come by this good fortune. Jerry had been, as Tess's father put it, a rich man's fancy woman. True, her lover was not what could by any stretch of the imagination be called rich, but he had been married, so Jerry had lived with him, as they say, in sin. Oh, the shame of it! Jerry's gentleman had owned a small bookshop just off Royal Avenue, and after he died, she inherited not only the shop, but also his house and a modest amount of money, a disagreeable bone of contention as far as his wife and two children were concerned. Indeed, there were many unpleasant incidents regarding the will going to probate, but to probate it went, and one action in the courts finally saw off the widow and her family. The point was that Geraldine's gentleman friend was certainly of sound mind when he wrote in his will, "To my legal wife Harriet, I bequeath neither jot nor tittle. The same applies to my children by Harriet. I have had to put up with Harriet's moaning, groaning, and volcanic temper for over 25 years, just as I have had to put up with the selfishness of my children. My wife has money of her own, and that should be enough for her and her brood." As things turned out, Jerry Murray died, untimely, 2 years later. Came home after Christmas shopping one Thursday evening and dropped down dead of a brain hemorrhage. In the lavatory, of all places. Jerry never had any sense of time or place. "Died as she lived," Tess overheard her father say. "Died as she lived with her knickers round her ankles." At the time, this had rather shocked Tessa. But memories were strong. She still remembered the police coming to break the news of Jerry's death, and the endless rationalization of why it was not morally wrong to accept what was willed to them. The house, the money, and more money when the shop was sold. Some of the arguments voiced appeared flawed to Tessa, but voiced they were, in almost Jesuitical terms. Of course, this would not be recognized by her father or mother, but even at her tender age, Tess saw through the whole charade. You do, at 14, don't you? You know the whole business of living. The facts of death come later. At 14, you're never going to die. By the age of 18, Teresa rejected just about everything held sacred by her parents, including the Roman Catholic faith. She'd also got herself out of the family rut, having worked unstintingly at school to the extent that she'd been able to go south, into the Free State, as they called it, and win a scholarship to Trinity College, Dublin. There she worked some more, reading law and getting herself a reasonable degree with the magic letters B.A. after her name. Her time at Trinity had also forged many links with people who would be useful to her later. On the night after the newlywed Gauntlets went to see the Flying Dutchman and spotted Kit Palfrey into the bargain, Teresa Murray arrived in Dublin from Belfast by train. but it had taken her a staggering 48 hours to make the simple 150-odd-mile journey from her nice little house in the suburbs of Belfast. For she had travelled with great, almost paranoid care, and had had one terrifying scare. On arrival, she took a taxi to the Gresham Hotel at the bottom of O'Connell Street, where she was treated with the usual civility accorded a regular visitor. After calling down to room service for smoked salmon sandwiches and a half bottle of Moet, she stripped, put on the toweling robe that came with the suite, and started to run a hot bath. She tipped well after signing the bill, then ate the sandwiches, finally taking a glass of the champagne through to the bathroom, where she took off the day's makeup and stepped into the hot water, which she had liberally sprinkled with eau de guerlain. Now she eased herself into the steaming bath, inching down until her whole body had acclimatized to the heat. At last she stretched out, took a sip of wine, wiggled her toes against the taps, and relaxed for the first time since she'd left Belfast. She was frightened, had been frightened since the previous evening, when things had gone very wrong. She'd taken every precaution, as she always did when the Dublin lawyer signalled there was a new contract to be picked up. She checked and double-checked when she left the house. She drove carefully, using all the usual routines to make certain that nobody was following her. And only when she was absolutely certain did she drive down and cross the border into the south. Travelling back to Belfast was, at that time, not an option. In London, inside the theatre, the Dutchman was just falling in love with the heroine as Tess Murray returned her car into the forecourt of the Dublin Airport Hotel. 20 minutes later, she was sitting in her room thinking about going down to dinner once she'd made the obligatory telephone call. She dialed the number, and when a male voice answered, she asked for Michael, knowing that it would in fact be either Sean or Fergus who was really answering. They worked in shifts, manning the phone in the clearing house kept for alchemist.
"Michael, it's Noala."
It had never happened before. The pause, followed by the realization that whoever was on the distant end was very drunk.
Oh, it's Noala. Grand. That'll mean there's traffic for alchemist.
This was followed by a raucous laugh. The fear was instant, for the clearing house was close to the border on the southern side, and she knew the area was still thick with electronic scanners left by people waiting to lock on to, or already locked on to, any telephone conversation to which they took a fancy. The Brits, the Garda, the remains of the Provos, even the RUC, whoever. She spluttered, stalled, then shouted,
"For God's sake, not to worry, Noala. And I know that's not your real name. We've been having the most wonderful piss up here. So just make a note that you called, and bloody fool,"
she yelled, before dropping the instrument back into its cradle. What to do? What to do? This was a serious breach of security, and could prove to be dangerous. In telephone conversations, they never mentioned alchemist. In the Dublin Airport Hotel, Tess Murray had reason to be frightened.